According to recent studies, about one-third of Americans can be categorized as obese, and between 1998 and 2006, the obesity rate in this country rose 37%. And as those waistlines expand, so does medical spending. According to the Centers for Disease Control, obesity-related illnesses accounted for an estimated $147 billion in 2008, nearly 10% of all U.S. medical costs. On today's edition of Please Explain, we're looking into what is causing this dramatic rise in obesity and the health risks that come with it. And joining us are Dr. Louis Arone, clinical professor of medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital, and director of the Comprehensive Weight Control Program, and Dr. Kelly Brunell, professor of psychology and epidemiology and public health director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. Welcome to our show.
Hi, Leonard.
Hello, Leonard.
Hello, let's begin with you. What's the difference between overweight and obese?
It's just a matter of scale. People who have more weight on them are considered to be obese. We measure this by the body mass index, and it's a little bit technical, the weight in kilograms over your height in meters squared, but basically someone who's about 30 or 35% above their ideal body weight is considered to be obese. Someone who's about 15% to 30% above their ideal body weight would be considered to be overweight. Once you get to the point of obesity, that's where the risk of having excess weight really increases dramatically.
Because suddenly we see an increase in negative health effects?
Yes. More than 60 illnesses have been associated with obesity, and it looks like the hormones that are produced by fat cells that are critical for the normal functioning of the body are produced in excess. Some are actually suppressed, and this leads to all these many diseases, everything from cancer to asthma to infertility, all of these things associated with obesity.
Kelly, what causes obesity? Is it as simple as consuming too much food and doing too little exercise?
Well, it does boil down to those two things. And when one looks at the cause of obesity in an individual, then genetics come into play and certain biological vulnerabilities. But the more important question is, why is the society becoming overweight? Not only the U.S., as you mentioned, but essentially every country in the world. And you simply can't blame that on biology. There's a changing environment, a toxic food and physical activity environment, if you will, that is leading to the overweight problems. The list goes on and on. Large portion sizes, heavy marketing of the food, sale of the unhealthy foods in schools would be just a few examples. There are other economic ones. But when you put this all together, it creates a perfect storm that makes the society highly vulnerable to weight gain. Some people can resist, but not many.
Well, there was an article in the Times the other day about how Manhattan is an area of thin people. So a certain amount of this is culture, isn't it?
Some of it's culture, but also people in Manhattan walk more. People in Manhattan, for the most part, have more money than people in some other parts of the country, and poverty is a very high risk factor for obesity. So Manhattan's not typical because of all those factors, but even in Manhattan, it's a different degree of terrible. The rates of obesity are very high there, as they are everywhere else in the country, but perhaps just a little less exaggerated.
How much is weight gain caused by the total number of calories ingested? How much by the kinds of food that we eat?
Go ahead, Louis. Well, one of the most interesting recent findings is that both of these things seem to play a role, and they're tied to each other. So that when you think about what's fattening about fattening food, it may be that fattening food, sweet, fatty, starchy food, causes a breakdown in some of the signaling pathways that tell us how much we've eaten, and it allows you to consume more of itself. So in other words, you don't feel appropriately full, and this is caused by resistance to certain hormones that should make you feel full. So in other words, when you eat a meal that is fattening, that is consisting of fattening foods, you don't feel full at the appropriate time and you continue to eat. Whereas if you eat healthy foods, fruits, vegetables, lean proteins, you feel full at an appropriate time and you stop eating. So that while the number of calories plays an important role, it may be that the quality of the food that we're eating, the composition of the food, is playing an important role in determining how much we eat.
Are you talking about foods that are heavy in carbohydrates?
Both carbohydrates and fats. So that when it comes, for example, to the issue of poverty and its relationship to obesity, there are studies showing that people who are of limited means tend to buy cheaper food. Cheaper food tend to be starches and sugar. Sugar is actually the cheapest food calorie for calorie. If you start eating sugar and starch, what happens is that may cause a breakdown in these physical mechanisms, and that may allow you to start eating more food. We're calling it a feed-forward mechanism that, again, you can eat more and more and more. It just keeps driving the system forward. So in other words, this puts an emphasis on prevention, an emphasis on starting very early in life and not allowing children to begin to start eating these foods because it can take whatever genetic susceptibility you have and really make it magnified. One of the most interesting things we've recognized about obesity is there's sort of a ratcheting phenomenon where it's a one-way trip. It's easy to go up, and everyone will tell you it's very easy to go up, but it's not so easy to go down. And how that happens is beginning to be elucidated, but that's what makes it so tough to treat.
My guests are Dr. Louis Aronne and Dr. Kelly Brownell. We're talking about obesity on today's Please Explain. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So I'm getting the feeling that you can be both malnourished and obese at the same time.
You know, where you see that most prominently are in families where you have a person can be malnourished and obese at the same time, but it often happens in families where you find one overweight person and a malnourished person. It happens in the same city, the same communities, the same country.
And they're eating the same foods?
Not necessarily, but the same set of conditions, heavy marketing, poverty, et cetera, can lead to both malnutrition and obesity depending on the particular place you are. And so it's one reason why the world concern with hunger coincides a lot with the world concern about obesity. And although it might seem like they're opposite ends of the continuum, they actually share a lot in common. It's very important to consider that in food policy.
How much of a factor is a person's metabolism?
Metabolism is an interesting question, and it does play a role, but it's a role that's difficult to determine because the errors of metabolism that lead to obesity are of such a small magnitude that it's very difficult to measure. It's less than 1% error in your metabolic rate, change in your metabolic rate, could lead to massive obesity. So while we think that there is some effect from that, the fact is that most of this is coming from what we're eating. But I think one of the examples you brought up, what's going on in Manhattan, what goes on in Europe, people who exercise regularly seem to not gain weight. And the reason some people believe is that if you're burning calories regularly, they don't have a chance to accumulate. So that regular exercise's most important role is to prevent the accumulation of calories. And so there, I think you can see how metabolism can prevent obesity.
Are the fat cells of obese people the same as the fat cells of someone of normal weight? Or are they greater in number? Or are they different in some way?
They can be both. They can be both greater in number and greater in size. And both of those situations occur. So, for example, there are people who are normal weight but have larger fat cells, and these people have many of the manifestations or many of the risks that we associate with obesity. So certain Southern Asians, for example, may not be very obese, but they have very few large fat cells, and so they develop the complications of obesity at a very low weight, whereas other people, for example, African-American women tend to have many smaller fat cells. They tend to be somewhat more resistant to them.
So you can be fat and fit to some
it
degree,
is possible.
not have increased risk of heart disease or, well, but we see a lot of diabetes in the African-American community. Is that related to this?
The poverty and some of the ethnic issues are very important. And yes, the rates of obesity are highest in the country in African Americans, followed by Hispanics, followed by Caucasians. And one has to ask why that would be the case. And there may be some biological vulnerabilities, as Dr. Aroney mentioned, but there are also issues such as poverty, such as targeted marketing, perhaps by the food industry. The low income drives people toward the least expensive foods, which tend to be the most calorie dense and nutrient poor. They live in neighborhoods where it's difficult to be physically active. There are any number of factors that can contribute to the relationship, but it's a real issue of concern.
Aren't there also different kinds of fat cells? There was an article in the New York Times yesterday about a new discovery about brown fat cells, the cells that burn fat off as heat. Does this mean that the more brown fat cells a body has, the more white fat cells they burn?
No, it's that the more brown fat you have, the more calories you burn as heat, as opposed to those people who have white fat cells where the calories get stored as energy. Young men have a lot of brown fat. That's why they can do insane things like go outside in the middle of winter with just a t-shirt on, because they're able to make their own heat. And what you saw in that paper was how the way in which the body controls that heat-making mechanism seems to have been elucidated by a research group at Harvard. And this is a very important finding in potentially developing new treatments for obesity.
According to National Health and Nutrition Examination surveys, Kelly, 17% of children ages 6 to 19 and 12.5% of children ages 2 to 5 are obese. Is that a dramatic increase? It sounds like it must be.
Yes, it's tripled in the last several decades, and all the numbers suggest continuing rises in childhood obesity in most places around the country. And if one extrapolates ahead into the years of these children, they're alarming. Concerns like diabetes in the 20s and all the complications, et cetera. And there have been projections that the current generation of children will be the first in the nation's history to lead shorter lives than their parents
did. But kids are generally more physically active than adults, and they're growing on top of that. So shouldn't it be unusual for children to be obese?
Children are a lot less physically active than they used to be. The amount of play out of doors has gone down a good bit. When I was a child, it was pretty boring to be in the house. But now it's boring to be out of the house compared to staying in because of the computer games and the internet, video, and thousands of channels on the television. And those things tend to keep kids inside. Safety concerns from the parents keep them inside. They're less physically active in school. But the biggest contributor, according to research, is the changes in food intake. And as Dr. Aroney mentioned, the changes in food intake mean more food, but also different kinds of food. And one issue of particular concern are the amount of calories children are getting in beverages, adults as well. And there seems to be, and so the sugared beverage consumption has gone through the roof. And in the mid-1990s, the lines crossed, and children in the country began consuming more sugared beverages than they do milk. And the one major concern with this is that the body doesn't seem to recognize calories in liquid form as well as it does calories in solid food. So your likelihood of adjusting your calorie intake at subsequent meals when you have a sugared beverage isn't very good. And therefore, one could see the ratcheting up that Dr. Aroney talked about. And that's why proposals like a sugared beverage tax are very much a part of the picture today.
Should I assume that obese children are likely to have obese parents?
The statistical likelihood of obese children, obese adults having obese children is higher than non-obese adults having obese children. But so many people are affected that the weight of the parents is becoming less and less an issue.
Louis, what is Prader-Willi syndrome?
Prader-Willi syndrome is a very rare genetic abnormality that causes very severe obesity and eating disorders. It's been very difficult to treat this problem.
But you say this is very rare, but this does lead to obesity. We also see people who are, I would call, big boned, who are more likely to put on a lot of weight. There are people who will tell you that the only reason they can't keep weight off is because they have a thyroid condition. Are all those things reasonable explanations for the kind of thing we're seeing these days?
Well, the thyroid issue is not exactly what it seems. It looks like there may be some final common pathways through which people pass as they begin to gain weight. And what we think is that resistance to certain key hormones, two of them by name are insulin and leptin, may be contributing to obesity, so that you eat fattening foods. These foods seem to actually cause resistance to those signaling hormones, and a manifestation of this could be a problem with thyroid hormone conversion. And so I think that when people talk about this thyroid hormone problem, they're actually talking about the underlying resistance issue, and it's actually not a thyroid problem. And you know, this is being worked out now, but it does contribute, but it's not actually, in my opinion, a thyroid problem.
We are talking with Dr. Louis Aronet, who is a clinical professor of medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital, director of the Comprehensive Weight Control Program, and founder of the Cardiometabolic Support Network, and Dr. Kelly Brownell, professor of psychology and epidemiology and public health director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. We invite your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-9692. Or you can leave a comment on our show page. We'll be back with more after this. I wonder if getting a frog in your throat is related in any way to obesity. Well, my guests are Dr. Kelly Brownell and Dr. Louis Aronet, and we are talking about obesity on today's Please Explain and taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Let's go right to those calls. Our first caller is Amy from Manhattan. Hi, Amy. You're on the air.
Hi, Leonard and guests. I was wondering, the guest mentioned that that this Prader-Willi syndrome includes eating disorders, and I was wondering if the mechanism is similar to that of eating disorders that occur outside of that context, with dopamine receptors and all that.
There are a number of different types of eating disorders. The eating disorders that are associated with Prader-Willi syndrome, which really fall into the category of binge eating, are unusual in that they're extremely severe. They're central, meaning that we know where in the brain they're from, and they're not exactly the same. So that they are a little bit different in that they have been better characterized than any other eating disorders that we have. But that notwithstanding, they've still been extremely difficult, if not impossible, to treat effectively.
Thank you so much for your call. We go now to Hunker from Queens. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. In light of the obesity epidemic that we're having, and considering the fact that, you know, the conventional solutions such as asking people to eat less and exercise more are having only a marginal effect, do the speakers think that it may be time to bring back some of the old harsher medications such as 2,4-dinitrophenol, such as the bendafedra, or the more widespread use of medicines such as rimonabant to cut people's appetites? I believe to this day nothing has ever been discovered that's as effective for weight loss as DNP, which is, you know, banned all the way in the 1930s.
And then we had the banning of fen-phen in 1997. Have any of those things been really effective in obesity cases?
You know, Lou can speak to the specifics of the medication because he knows an awful lot about that. But I think in order to deal with obesity as a public health issue, if we want less of it in the society, we're never going to get there by treating it. It's just a very difficult problem to get rid of. Treatments tend to be very expensive, and it just cries out for prevention. So treatment is a very important thing for individuals who have the problem. You want to try to help them as much as you can. But for every case you successfully treat, there are hundreds or thousands more becoming overweight because of the bad environment. So investing a lot of money in trying to find a drug that tries to counteract the impact of the bad environment doesn't make sense to me. It makes sense to try to deal with the environment. But given that, there are differences in how these medications work, and that's what Dr. Aronne is expert in.
Lou?
Well, the first thing I'd like to say is I agree with Kelly that this is a two-pronged attack. The first thing is trying to prevent more people from becoming obese. But that being said, we have a lot of people who are costing the country a fortune, and I believe that it's integral to saving healthcare dollars to find effective treatments for obesity.
But we've been told again and again that diets don't seem to work. They may work for a short time, but they don't really work. And I'm not sure how effective they are with people who are truly obese.
Well, in some people, they do work. But the point is that if they don't work, I don't think we should give up. I think that if they don't work, then we should move to the next step. And what we've had right now is sort of a jump from diet to nihilism and then surgery. And I believe that what's evolving is a treatment paradigm that will be like many other treatments where we will use medication that's been proven to be safe and effective and is acceptable to the Food and Drug Administration as part of that. And the point of using medication is not to try to look good in a bathing suit, but to try to not have to take a diabetes medicine or a blood pressure medicine. So if you look at our program, for example, the average patient who comes to see us is taking 7 medications. The average patient is using continuous positive airway pressure, a pump for sleep apnea, and doesn't want to have surgery. And so we're trying to treat them medically in an effort not to have surgery. That's their choice.
Well, wouldn't surgery be the quite expensive and absolutely the last possible approach if all else fails?
Surgery is expensive. However, it's been shown to be a cost-effective treatment. There are now what are called cost-effective analyses of surgery, like gastric bypass surgery, that show that within a few years, 3 to 4 years, an insurer would get back the cost of doing surgery in healthcare costs saved. And in fact, the surgical societies are saying that we should be doing more surgery. We should be doing surgery on people with a lower body mass index than the current criteria. We should be doing surgery in almost anybody who has diabetes because it's been shown that you can cure diabetes with gastric bypass surgery. So there may be a bigger role for surgery in the future. But the medical treatments, I think, are very promising. There are some new treatments. The treatments that the caller mentioned, many of them have problems that were very sporadic, like a 1 in 5,000 side effect. But the FDA will not consider a treatment with even a 1 in 5,000 or a 1 in 10,000 side effect because when you treat 1 million people, that's a lot of serious side effects. When you use obesity treatments, you're treating a lot of people, and so we need very, very safe treatments for obesity if we're going to be able to get out there and do anything that's useful.
Well, if one-third of all Americans can be categorized as obese, we're talking about 100 million people, aren't we?
That's where the
rub comes with treating obesity, is that even when you have the successes, which are pretty sporadic, and very few people maintain the weight loss, although some do, the cost that goes in, the cost per pound loss really becomes enormous. So while the surgery argument makes sense to some extent, think about how many people would potentially qualify and who would put up all that money, and that's why the prevention becomes so important. And Leonard, to give you an example of what you're, the sort of environmental tidal wave that you're fighting against, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which is a sort of a gift from heaven, is spending $500 million to try to help deal with the childhood obesity problem over 5 years, so $100 million per year. The food industry spends $100 million by January 4th each year just marketing junk food just to children. And so all the imploring in the world isn't going to work, and all the treatment in the world isn't going to work, and we really have to be pretty bold and courageous with some public policy initiatives.
Are the sugar substitutes like Splenda and Sweet and Low a good idea? Do they help fight obesity?
Highly controversial. There are some concerns with safety, although the science on that isn't strong enough yet to make an argument pro or con. And the other concern is whether they really help people lose weight. And the literature on that is mixed. Some studies show that the overweight people are consuming more sugared beverages, and then some people say, well, the artificially sweetened beverages, rather, and that's why the people are overweight. But of course, overweight people are drinking the artificially sweetened beverages to help control their weight. So the studies on that aren't really very good, not yet. And so I suspect at some point there might be a call for decreasing consumption of artificially sweetened beverages. But right now the science isn't strong enough.
My guests are Dr. Kelly Brownell and Dr. Louis Arané. And we're talking about obesity on today's Please Explain and taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Kay from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. I love your show. I listen all the time. I have a question. I started out at 361 pounds. I'm down to 248. I did it through diet and exercise. But I took on a personal trainer who's been asking me to do these special exercises, which he calls metabolic conditioning. They're very painful. They're supposed to induce muscle failure. And apparently they're supposed to increase the metabolic rate on how you burn fat. And I'm wondering if there's any validity to this or research or studies about this. I'll listen.
I don't know what type of exercise she's recommending specifically, but the type of exercise that some studies have shown is most effective for maintaining the lowest weight is interval training, where you vary the intensity of exercise. What that does is sort of tricks the muscle into thinking that you're going to have to do the highest level of physical activity at any second. So more intense levels of physical activity seem to help maintain a lower body weight or lower the set point by stimulating muscle metabolism. So if that's the type of exercise that she's recommending, there is some sensibility to that. So the low levels of physical activity are helpful. There's no question that walking around the city, we've seen people lose and maintain a lot of weight. But if you want to know what the best activity is, it's varying the level of intensity, walking very fast for one block, then slow, then fast, and then slow.
Thank you so much for your call. Kelly Beryl from Manhattan says, let's stop demonizing these people. It's so hard for so many of them to lose weight.
Boy, Beryl's absolutely right. There's our center, the Rudd Center at Yale, does a tremendous amount of work on issues of bias and discrimination against overweight people. And so what we think is important is not to demonize overweight people, which is happening around the country a good bit, because people are blamed for their problem, and it's considered by many in society to be a problem of lack of discipline, personal failing, and lack of personal responsibility. Well, that's a very hard argument to justify. If you take laboratory animals and put in foods you can buy at a 7-Eleven, they can get very obese. Hard to argue that that's personal responsibility. And when people move from the U.S., they lose weight. They move to the U.S., they gain weight. They certainly haven't changed their personality. And so it's obviously the environment that's at fault. So what we think is very important to do is to attack the problem of obesity, to try to prevent it from happening in the first place, but be nothing but kind and compassionate to people who have the problem so that there's no bias and discrimination leveled at them.
Well, you're a psychologist, and one listener says we seem to be missing the point here. What about addressing this as an emotional situation? Many people self-medicate by eating.
That's correct. But that would be true in a country like Somalia or Ethiopia. People could self-medicate by eating, but their food conditions are different. So while it's
they're not getting all the processed food in the supermarkets?
That's exactly right. There are a number of things like that that make our culture different from theirs. So the point is a good one, and some people do eat to self-medicate. But the question is, how do you change the environment in ways that make healthy choices the default rather than unhealthy choices? So when a child is in a school and picking something from a vending machine, how can healthy choices become the default? When you're in a work site and the vending machine is there, when you're in a rest area on the turnpike, when you're looking at television, and like for example, the American Idol show, at one point Coca-Cola glasses showed up in front of those judges, and so that was a very multi-million dollar deal between Coca-Cola and that company, American Idol people, to try to promote Coca-Cola. So millions and millions of children are watching that, and it has a powerful impact on them, or Coke wouldn't pay all that money to do it.
So who should we be blaming here? Should we be blaming the people who have allowed themselves to gain so much weight? I mean, they're fully aware of the fact when they look in the mirror. Or should we blame the people who advertise, the people who put Coke bottles in front of the American Idol judges?
Well, to me, blaming the people who yield to that, those kind of things, doesn't make much sense at all. We've been doing that for 30, 40 years as we've been addressing the obesity crisis, and it only gets worse and worse. And there's not an overweight person out there who doesn't know that they're overweight and would prefer not to be that way if they had the choice. So it's really looking at the conditions that are driving the problem rather than the personal factors in the individuals who have it, where I think the real action is.
Well, we're pretty much out of time, and I want to get Louis into this. Dr. Arane, as a doctor who's involved in the medical side of all of this, do you have any thoughts about who we should blame or how we should go about it? Are we going to have new drugs that will just eliminate any worry about who's responsible ultimately?
I don't think we're going to have drugs that are that effective, but I do think we will have effective treatments in the relatively near future. And again, I think that I see these as a substitute for waiting for diabetes, high blood pressure, and heart disease to occur. So they're not a panacea. I think that what we need is a two-pronged attack. I think the type of approach that Kelly is talking about is really the cornerstone of what we need to do. As a society, the type of work that I'm doing in trying to treat obesity on a medical level is when we've failed as a society at preventing this problem. So that doing things like taxing sodas or sugared beverages makes so much sense.
Mayor Bloomberg banned the use of trans fats in New York.
Well, I think we've had all you have to do is stand around at a store in New York City and look at people who are looking at the calorie counts of the foods in a Starbucks, and you'll realize the impact that this can have.
I want to thank the two of you so much for being with us today on this Please Explain look at obesity. I've been talking with Dr. Louis Arane, who is clinical professor of medicine at the Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital, and director of the Comprehensive Weight Control Program and founder of the Cardiometabolic Support Network, and with Dr. Kelly Brownell, professor of psychology and epidemiology and public health director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Len.
Thank you.
On Monday's show, On the Media's co-host Bob Garfield looks at how businesses and institutions can adapt to the digital revolution. And then, Underappreciated, our summer reading series examines Andre Bailly's novel Petersburg, also the life of leftist muckraker I.F. Stone, plus we take a sneak peek at a film festival about New York's train system, and psychology professor Robert Feldman explains the motivations behind deception. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Adam Delahanty and Sherry Shan. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you next week.